When Congress passed a farm bill last month that expected to save more than $8.5 billion over 10 years by tightening what many say is a loophole in the food stamp or SNAP program. But that's not what's happening. Congress left states an opening to avoid the cuts. And it turns out that's exactly what they're doing, as NPR's Pam Fessler reports.
This involves a quirk in federal law known as HEAT and EAT. It allows those who get home heating aid to receive additional food stamps. And states figured out they could give people just $1 a year in heating aid to trigger the provision. They said it cut red tape and helped those in need. But the maneuver was criticized by both Republicans and Democrats, like Senate Agriculture Committee Chair Debbie Stabenow.
Sending out $1 checks to everyone isn't the intent of Congress. It is undermining the integrity of the program, in my judgment.
So last month, Congress agreed to increase to $20 the amount of utility aid that states would have to pay to trigger HEAT and EAT, with the expectation that most of the 17 states now taking advantage of it would decide it was no longer worth their while. Congress predicted that 850,000 food stamp recipients would have their benefits cut an average $90 a month. But turns out, Congress was wrong.
Governor Corbett took the appropriate steps to make sure that Pennsylvania's children are fed and that families in need are not impacted by what is one of the most substantial federal cuts to food benefits.
That's Kate Gillis, spokeswoman for Pennsylvania's Department of Public Welfare. The state's Republican governor, Tom Corbett, last week said he would spend the extra $8 million in heating aid this year required to protect $300 million in food stamps for state residents. Since it's all federal money, Gillis says it's kind of a win-win for the state.
That $300 million that the individuals received through SNAP assistance is then spent in Pennsylvania.
Other states have come to the same conclusion, erasing most of the savings that Congress hoped to achieve. In recent days, the governors of New York, Connecticut, Rhode Island, Oregon, and Montana have all announced that they, too, will avoid the food stamp cuts. Washington, D.C. is planning to do the same. And the head of Vermont's Department of Children and Families, Dave Iacovone, told Vermont Public Radio he hopes to preserve $6 million in food stamps, in part because Congress also trimmed benefits last year.
This is real important because if we don't make this change, that's on top of an actual $10 million reduction.
The response from Congress? House Speaker John Boehner made clear to reporters yesterday that he, for one, is not happy.
States have found ways to cheat once again on signing up people for food stamps. And so I would hope that the House would act to try to stop this cheating and this fraud from continuing.
But whether Congress will act isn't clear. It took years for the House and Senate to agree on even these cuts. Republicans want much larger reductions in the food stamp program. Needless to say, anti-hunger advocates are thrilled by what's going on. Jim Weil, president of the Food Research and Action Center, says the debate over whether states are exploiting a loophole misses the bigger issue.
Food stamps are not enough to get the vast majority of recipients through the month. The Farm Bill should have had a debate about how to improve benefits, not how to cut benefits.
Now he hopes additional states will use HEAT and EAT to boost food stamp benefits even more. Pam Fessler, NPR News.
Now it's time for Faith Matters. That's the part of the program where we talk about matters of faith, religion, and spirituality. You may know that we are in the Lenten season. In the Christian tradition, it is the time of preparation before Easter, which is the observance leading up to the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. For many Christians around the world, it is a formal period of reflection and fasting. But Christians all over the world have different fasting traditions. Some hold off on meat. Others cut out all animal products, including dairy. Some people eat only raw food. We wanted to hear more about these traditions and how they develop, so we called Professor Frederick Douglass Opie. He is an historian at Babson College, and he writes the blog Food as a Lens. And we are happy that he was able to stop by our Washington, D.C. studios. Professor Opie, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, Michelle.
Why do Christians fast during Lent?
It's a way of remembering what Jesus Christ had done for humanity on the cross and coming in solidarity with a sacrifice that he made. So you're sacrificing something that might be a normal luxury in your diet.
There are, and you were telling us, and we were reading on the blog, that there are all kinds of food traditions or fasting traditions. Could you just tell us just a couple of them?
I'll give you a couple. Depending on where you are and what your topography is, what you have access to. I was looking at some sources from the Great Depression era. And in New Mexico, you see that most of the people of Mexican descent will eat things like rice or like a soup made from rice. They'll eat bread made from bran. They'll do fish. They'll do beans. Now, in New England, when you looked at recipes, I was just looking at, again, some from the turn of the century, and there was an emphasis on soups that are more like ragouts, more like stews, and they're all cream-based. So if you think about the region where people are from, Cincinnati, in that area where there's a lot of rivers in that area, you see people also emphasizing fish, all kinds of fish, and you have somebody writing a column around 1910 talking about the fish in the local market, but then all the fish, also the fish that are imported to Cincinnati, to the readers of the paper.
Speaking of fish, you know, fish looms large in my, you know, thinking about Lent. I mean, I don't know about you, but I grew up having fish on Fridays, specifically during Lent, but often throughout the year. Do you know how that got started?
It's interesting.
And to be honest, most of my neighbors did too. I didn't know any other way. Why, do you have any idea why that is or how that started?
The historical record, when you look at the sources, newspaper sources, again, I looked at sources going all the way back to 1894. Certainly there's earlier ones, but I didn't have access to them. And what I found is that most people don't know how it started. Why fish? We just know it becomes a natural replacement and something that was sanctioned by the church as acceptable alternative to meat.
And is this a Catholic thing, a Protestant thing, a black thing, as it were? I remember just as an African American, that, you know, looms large to me as the thing that one did.
It transcends cultures. So you see it within the African-American church, you see it within the white church, Catholic, Protestant. Certainly as African-Americans, the people who originate from West and Central Africa, well, we had fish culture as many of us grew up in the Niger River Valley. So that's probably a continuation of what we did before. But also when we were enslaved by people who came from, for example, British culture, French culture, it was part of their religious culture that was introduced to us.
One of the things you were also telling us is that the fish tradition actually gave rise to a whole kind of economic empowerment opportunity. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
It's almost like a cottage industry around it. I think of a woman in New Orleans who was known as the queen of fish fry. And in her community, and particularly New Orleans being a Catholic city, it's one of those things, as you also mentioned, where people every Friday they ate fish. But during the Lenten season, it's Wednesday and Friday. So there are women who set up cottage industry where they would sell food out of their house. You'd put your order in the morning, say in New Orleans, go to work, show up on the way back, and pick up this delicious meal for a very inexpensive amount of money that was great home-cooked food.
And this did what for the women who were running these fish fries? Were they able to increase their standing because of this, or what did this do
for them? They definitely had a standing. I'm thinking about the woman known as the Queen of Fish Fry. She was one of these people that if you needed to gain money, for example, bail for a loved one, you would go to her, you would provide her with the necessity to cook the fish, and then she would have you put on a party to raise money. Soon we see the same thing with rent parties in places like Harlem. So they function in that similar way.
And also you were telling us about, you highlighted on your blog that that people with Mexican heritage eat something called, what, nopales or cactus petals?
Yes.
During Lent. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, nopales, again, as you mentioned, they are the cactus petals, and they coincide with the Lenten season. So it's the thing that's, you know, in fruit, it's blooming. So it's one of those things. I spent time in Mexico learning Spanish, and one of those delicious dishes where you take the nopales, you cut them up, and you'll put them like in a vinaigrette, and they're really delicious. Most of us who have never had them think, you know, ideally eating cactus is crazy, but it is a staple within Mexican culture and society.
Is there any through line to what you've seen about Lenten observances?
Things that are consistent across borders and across cultures.
Because it's interesting to me that some people actually eat cream or eat cream-based things. When a lot of the people I grew up with, that's the opposite of what you do. In fact, I know a lot of people who, in this area, people who are from East Africa, like, remove all the dairy from their diets at this time.
You know, those of us of African descent, most of us are lactose intolerant, so that's where that comes from. But the consistency I see is that we're not going to eat meat. It's fish that's the biggest replacement. It's the consumption of a lot of soup during that particular period of time. And the whole idea that's consistent before Lent is this whole idea of Fat Tuesday, or what people call Shrove Tuesday. Or in England, it was known as Pancake Tuesday. So there are some consistencies you see with the party before Ash Wednesday and then going to repentance and abstinence for the rest of the year until Easter, and then that big meal on Easter Sunday.
Yeah, before we let you go, and if I hope you don't mind getting personal, it seems a little incongruous to ask if you have any favorite recipes for a season of fasting, but in all of your travels, I wonder if you do.
No, absolutely. In the series I do, looking at Lent through the lens of food, I do provide recipes, and there's some traditional recipes that people eat no matter what their culture, and I provide the vegan version of that so people can continue to eat and enjoy. But I'd say one of the big ones I would say are a lot of pulses or beans and, you know, black beans and rice, things like that. Those are some kind of traditional dishes. And I have a whole connection to a series I did on fish and food. So there's a lot of fish recipes that people would have if they go to the blog foodislens.com.
Are you personally fasting, if you don't mind my asking? How do you observe the fast?
You know, fasting means many things. You don't have to fast food. You could fast something like Facebook. You could fast something like constantly checking your email. You could fast chocolate. You could fast TV, your favorite TV show. I can think of a number of things that people could fast that might be more important than food, i.e. coffee.
Please, so there's don't a lot say of that. Things. Don't say that.
I'm sorry.
Don't
I'm sorry.
Say that.
I'm messing with people.
I think the day, I can't even envision the day.
But then it would be an important fast for you because you'd really be making a sacrifice.
No, this is not about me. Let's turn it back to you. Let's turn it back to you. I think I asked if you were fasting for Lent and how you
Michelle,
are observing
Michelle,
that.
Michelle, you saw me trying to squeeze out of it. Honestly, in preparation for the interview, I had to do some reflection. And I can tell you, as a father, both me and my wife are professors. We have an 8 and 11-year-old. And I think I got kind of caught up in forgetting what season it was and had to reflect on some things I need to do.
That was Professor Frederick Douglass Opie. He is a food blogger. His blog is foodasalens.com. He's a historian at Babson College, and we caught up with him here in Washington, D.C. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Okay, a big 700-year-old ceramic jug is front and center at a museum on the National Mall here in Washington, D.C. The Smithsonian's Sackler Gallery, where the specialty is Asian art and culture, is displaying the ancient jug that helped launch Japan's tea culture. NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg went over to see and to sip.
At a table at the Sackler, Callie O'Brien, in charge of marketing for Domatcha Tea Company, is mixing up a sippable.
Yeah, a half a teaspoon of matcha and then a little bit of hot water, about an ounce, and make a paste.
In a small, beautiful ceramic bowl with a delicate bamboo whisk, she's whipping the paste into a nice froth. So no bags, huh? No Lipton,
no,
nothing you dunk?
No, this stems back about 800 years.
To a time when tea was rare in Japan and arrived from China in ceramic storage jars. Andrew Watsky, professor of Japanese art history at Princeton, contemplates the main jar on view. It has a name, Chigusa.
Professor, to me, forgive, this mm-hmm. looks like a big brown jug.
Mm-hmm. It is a big brown jar.
Made in China, with little care or attention, Chinese ceramists just churned them out, stuffed tea leaves into them, and shipped them off.
This is Tupperware. This is the Chinese version of Tupperware.
But once the workaday storage jugs reached Japan, they became objects of aesthetic contemplation and often reverence. Today, the jugs provide fascinating windows into an ancient culture. In the 16th century, a tea ritual arose around them. In homes, separate areas were created for tea drinking.
They had specially designed tea rooms, usually very, very small, self-enclosed spaces.
No windows, a few tatami mats, and just enough space to hold the host and two or three of his guests.
What you're doing is sitting there and you are focused on those very few objects that are there.
The jug, wrapped by then in intricately tied pale blue silk cords, the mouth of the jug covered in Chinese brocade, plus a few bowls, whisks, other implements, and the hot whisked green tea that tastes like spring and grassy lawns.
Tea is fundamentally, or one of its fundamental aspects, is to study objects and learn how to look.
And who was involved in this careful 16th century inspection and contemplation? Not the hoi polloi. They were drinking roasted barley brews. No, tea was a drink for the Japanese elite, rich merchants, and the warriors who ruled the country. Men, women wouldn't get involved with tea ceremonies until the late 19th century, powerful men who went beyond money and weapons to become enlightened individuals.
To be politically powerful at this time also meant that you had to show that you had some sort of cultural sophistication as well.
And so you sipped and examined and appreciated the glaze of the jug those Chinese had just slapped onto their clay, how it moved across the surface and created the occasional blob or blip, and you schmoozed about the beauty of it all. Clearly, tea then was far more than a drink.
Tea becomes a place where these people of different social strata could get together and talk and be together, not to talk about war, not to talk about business, but to engage in their shared interest in this aesthetic pursuit.
And then some of them went home and wrote about it in their diaries. The date, the place, time of day, who was there, objects used, all described in great detail. Toward the end of the next century, the 17th, Japan got tea pots and little leaf-stuffed balls that you dunked in hot water. Tea drinking became more widespread, and then along came bags. Today, the ancient rituals are still taught and observed by some, but today's Japanese are crazy for coffee, and a cult of coffee preparation has developed that's at least as complicated as the 16th century tea ceremonies. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
I'm sure you're thinking you want to see a picture of the jug that Susan was telling us about. You can at our website, npr.org. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm David Green.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. Some matches are made in heaven. Introducing Brussels kale, a combination of two favorites of the urban farm-to-table crowd. Created by a UK seed company, it has the leafy look of kale and its peppery taste, added to the cabbagey taste of Brussels sprouts. Yum! You can buy Brussels kale now in Ohio and Pennsylvania, and it will debut nationally this fall under a new, presumably more exciting name. It's Morning Edition.